We recorded this episode on September 15th, and we did it while social distancing at our homes because of COVID-19. For about 6 months, we've been producing this show from home, and we know that many of you, our listeners, are also self-isolating, working from home or practicing some sort of social distancing to help flatten the curve during the COVID-19 pandemic.
At Live Science, our editors and reporters are tracking and covering the latest news, discoveries, and data about the new coronavirus, the COVID-19 disease, how it spreads, and how it affects people. On our website, you can find updates and breaking news from across the U.S., from the CDC and the World Health Organization, and from researchers around the world.
But we also hope that by continuing to bring you life's little mysteries, we can all continue to be reminded of the amazing science that's all around us.
Thanks for listening. Keep safe and stay healthy.
Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, editor-in-chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a senior writer at Live Science. The world can be a pretty mysterious place, and we at Live Science love to ask and answer questions about mysteries big and small, about ancient civilizations, our planet and solar system, the plants and animals that live alongside us, our bodies and how they work, and technologies that we use every day.
Each episode of this podcast introduces mysterious questions, and we think the answers will really surprise you.
We'll also hear about cutting-edge research in labs and in fieldwork around the world to answer these and other intriguing science questions.
In today's episode of Life's Little Mysteries, we'll take a closer look at the mysterious single-cell microbes that are simpler than any other organism, yet are still intriguingly complex. Bacteria.
Bacteria gets a really bad rap. I think that in general, people have negative feelings about bacteria because, you know, they associate it with disease or with infection. But bacteria are really, really fascinating. And so I'm glad we're finally taking a chance to, you know, like talk them up a little and, you know, about what they are and just some of the, you know, some of the positive things about bacteria, too.
Right. So they don't just make us bacteria, don't just make us sick. They're just pretty fascinating organisms.
Oh yeah, they're you know, there's so much more than that. So bacteria, they're fairly as far as life goes. I mean, life on Earth takes many forms. There are many complex forms of life with many cells. So, you know, a human for example has what is it? Is a human has trillions of cells.
30 trillion or so cells, yeah.
But there are forms of life that are just one cell. And that's bacteria. Well, bacteria is one of them. There are other forms of single-celled life. But even though bacteria are just single-celled organisms, they pose many mysteries that scientists are still trying to solve. And there's so many reasons why they're fascinating.
Right. I mean, bacteria can live just about anywhere. They do pretty wacky things. They can align themselves with Earth's magnetic field.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, they can make us sick, but bacteria can also make us well, make us healthier.
So what are bacteria at their core and what do they look like?
Yeah, I think because we can't see them as humans, you know, we just, this unknown world, like imagining what they actually look like is a hard concept.
Right. So bacteria, which is the plural, the singular is bacterium, they are single-celled organisms called prokaryotes. But they're not the only prokaryotes.
Bacteria share this category with archaea, which is another group of single-celled organisms, but they're a little different from bacteria in the composition of the cell wall and the membrane that encloses them.
Right. And prokaryotes, of course, are different from eukaryotes, which are cells with a membrane-covered nucleus and also organelles. So prokaryotes have this very simple internal structure that lacks a nucleus. They have DNA that either floats freely in a twisted mass of thread-like structures, which is called the nucleoid, or in separate circular pieces of DNA called plasmids.
Yeah, which is kind of cool because you think of DNA as inside its own little structure. And because prokaryotes are so simple, it's just kind of floating around in there in whatever form or, you know, shape it takes.
Right, right. So peering inside the bacteria. So instead of a nucleus, you have either this, like, you know, this little like knot of DNA or little circular pieces of DNA. And then there are also these spherical units called ribosomes, which is where proteins are assembled from individual amino acids using information that's encoded in ribosomal RNA.
Most bacterial cells have actually two protective coverings. So they have this outer cell wall, and right inside that, they have an inner cell membrane.
Right. But there are certain bacteria that don't have a cell wall at all. And then there's some bacteria that have a third protective layer called the capsule. So a lot of diversity.
So some bacteria also have these little teensy whip-like extensions, and they cover the surface of the bacteria. The long ones are called flagella, and the short ones are called pili. And these little extensions help the bacteria to move around, attached to its host, which sounds a little bit creepy, like almost like they're little animals, even though they're not.
But it's kind of cute also. Like just picture all these bacteria just kind of, using these to just kind of swim around.
How long have bacteria been around? How long have they been on Earth?
Well, actually, the earliest forms of life on Earth were microbial. And so, and microbes are thought to have emerged on Earth only about 1 billion years after Earth formed. So the first forms of life probably showed up about 3.5 billion years ago, something like that. So there are graphite traces in a zircon that dates to about 4.1 billion years ago. So this tells scientists that carbon, which is an important component of life on Earth, was already in place in Earth within 1 billion years. So, and then another ingredient for life was probably cyanide, which could potentially have traveled to an early Earth on primitive meteorites. And then that would have contributed to chemical reactions that eventually produced living cells like bacteria.
Right. So the cyanide somehow triggered the reactions, I think, that formed the amino acids that then could shape these bacteria or other microbes.
Right. So as far as what evidence is there that bacteria were around billions of years ago? There are fossils of these things called microbial mats. So these are essentially millions of microorganisms that fossilized together, and these date to billions of years ago. And these are widely thought to be the oldest examples of life on Earth. Though there is some debate among researchers about whether or not the organic molecules in these ancient fossils are signs of living organisms or whether they're just organic material. But in 2017, a team of researchers identified fossilized microbial evidence in Canada that may be between 3.77 billion and 4.29 billion years old. It's just amazing to me that, you think of bacteria on a scale. There are these organisms that are too small to see with the naked eye, but that congregated together in the millions, that this could be something that could fossilize and that scientists would be able to
study. For that long,
right.
4.29 billion years is incredible.
Right. So these microbial mats are, there is some debate about this, but among many researchers, these are considered to be the earliest fossilized evidence of life on Earth. This is actually evidence of microbes that lived billions of years ago. So other researchers are investigating these objects called stromatolites. These are dome-like rock structures that were constructed by ancient microbial communities. And so there are stromatolites in Greenland that may be as much as 3.7 billion years old. So this is another example of microbial fossil evidence that's billions of years old.
Have scientists found anything that old that they can sort of see what the bacteria would have looked like or the microbial life would have looked like?
Well, because they're looking at these masses of, what were once living microbes, it's not possible for them to, essentially tease out a single microbe from that and be able to say definitively this is what it looked like. So essentially these give them a snapshot of microbial life, but not necessarily of individual microbes. But what's actually even more amazing is that some of these ancient microbes or these communities of ancient microbes are actually that lived, hundreds of millions of years ago are actually still alive today.
That's incredible.
Yeah. No, scientists have found bacteria in deep sea rocks that they say that have survived for more than 100 million years, which is pretty amazing.
So we have this evidence, but how long have scientists been observing and studying bacteria? Like, how long have we known bacteria existed?
Right, right. So, yes, yeah, so even though bacteria have been around for billions of years, you know, obviously our interactions with them or our knowledge of them is something that's comparatively recent. So bacteria were first detected by the Dutch scientist Antonie van Leeuwenhoek. I really hope my Dutch my Dutch husband is not going to judge me too harshly on my pronunciation of that. Leeuwenhoek in 1676, and he observed them using a microscope of his own design, and he called them animalcules.
Which, you know, if they were called animalcules today, would we think they're cute?
We probably would. It's a much cuter name than bacteria, that's for sure. He came up with this word as a way for describing all kinds of microscopic life, because obviously bacteria are not the only microbes in town. There are many types of microbial life that are not necessarily bacteria, and animalcules was what was used to describe all of them. And yes, it does sound much more adorable.
So what about the bacteria, the word bacteria or the group bacteria? When did scientists first realize that was their, you know, that they were a separate entity?
Well, the word, the genus Bacterium, that was introduced in the 19th century by the German zoologist Christian Gottfried Ehrenberg. And it took a while for researchers to actually figure out how to classify these microbes. I mean, animalcules, that name seems to signify that they were first, you know, they were first viewed as some kind of super tiny animal. But when they were first classified, they were actually bacteria were first classified as plants, which seems a little weird. But then in 1866, they were moved to the kingdom, which is called protists, which was also, again, just like this big basket for putting all microscopic life, including other types of eukaryotes like algae, which are eukaryotes, but not bacteria. And then later, bacteria were moved into their own kingdom.
So they got their own big classification.
Their own domain, right? Kingdom in the scientific term, right? So the kingdom bacteria is part of the larger group, which is called the empire of prokaryota.
And so today, how do scientists now that we probably, you know, we know so much more about them, we've discovered so many more bacteria types, how are they classified?
Well, bacteria are divided into five groups within prokaryota, according to the Microbiology Society. And I did not know this, but it's based on their shape, which seems like a really straightforward way to do it. So because bacteria can be spherical, they can be rod-shaped, they can be spiral-shaped, they can be comma-shaped, or shaped like corkscrews. And so these five groups, that's how bacteria are classified, is just according to their shape.
Right. And then they can also, all these different shapes can either occur as a single cell, or they can pair up, or chains, or clusters, like we
exactly.
were talking about the mass.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And so these organisms, super simple. They're like this little blob. They have, you know, DNA floating around. How do they do things like eat and mate or reproduce?
I know it can be hard to imagine how something that's, you know, a form of life that is so simple, that is just one cell. Like, how does it do all these, you know, how does it behave? How does it do all these complicated behaviors that,
right.
that we're still trying to figure out how more complex animals do them. So as far as eating, they can eat through photosynthesis. There are a few ways they can do this. Photosynthesis is one of them. They can also extract nutrients from decomposing dead organisms and waste, breaking down chemical compounds. They can also have mutualistic or parasitic relationships with other organisms. So, a parasitic example is some disease-causing bacteria, and bacteria that act as parasites include those that cause the diseases cholera, smallpox, syphilis, and the bubonic plague.
And so how do they make more of each other?
Well, for reproduction, most bacteria multiply by a process that's called binary fission. So what this means is that you have a single bacterial cell, and this is called the parent. It makes a copy of its DNA, and then it gets bigger by essentially doubling all of its cellular content. And then what happens is the cell splits apart, pushes the duplicated material out, and then what you have is two identical daughter cells, is what they're called. So that's one form of reproduction. Then another one is that some bacterial species, they reproduce through a process called budding, in which case the daughter cell starts to grow as an offshoot of the parent. So it starts off as this little teeny tiny nub on the attached to the cell wall of the parent bacterium, and then it grows until it's the same size as its parent, and then it just, boop, splits off.
So that would be really cool to see under a microscope. That's really cute. watching this reproduction take place.
Yeah. And then when that happens, when reproduction through that, through binary fission or budding, when that happens, the DNA of the parents and the offspring are identical.
So they're like clones, kind of.
Right. Which is, you know, which is not necessarily the greatest thing for, you know, for a species, because mutations and variations in genetic material are what cause new species to evolve. And so the way that bacterial cells can introduce variation into their genetic material, they can actually integrate additional DNA from their surroundings into their genome.
So they sort of steal it from other places and incorporate it.
They're DNA thieves. So this is known as horizontal gene transfer. And what that means is that this allows for genetic variation that helps bacteria adapt and survive, which is something that's necessary as their environment changes. But there are also cool things. There are also really cool things about bacteria that are just straight up amazing things about these single-celled organisms.
And I think, Mindy, you found out something really cool about a bacteria that glows.
And let me tell you about them, right? As I was actually, you know, doing a little research about bacteria, and I did not know about this one. So I found out about a type of bacteria called Photorhabdus luminescens. And this is a glowing bacteria. So this is actually a bacteria that kind of came to people's attention during the American Civil War.
Wow.
Because this bacteria got into open wounds and made them glow.
How scary. Yeah.
So these soldiers' wounds would be glowing with this strange green light, and you know, they didn't know what it was, but you know, obviously on the, you know, these field medics during the Civil War, they were not going to be doing, you know, we're not going to be doing in-depth investigation of wounds with microscopes. They just needed to treat injuries as quickly as they could. But they did notice that the soldiers who had this, like, you know, strange green glow in their wounds, they seemed to recover faster. And the wounds seem to heal better. And so it seems like this, actually, to the point where they called, they nicknamed this the angel's glow. And so what's likely is that this type of bacteria actually had antibiotic properties.
Yeah.
So it would combat, right. So if it got into the wounds, it would actually help to fight off infection.
And another pretty cool bacteria is Dinococcus radiodurans. And this one is a pretty extreme bacteria. It actually has an entry in the Guinness World Records as the most radiation resistant life form. This bacteria can withstand 3,000 times the amount of gamma radiation that would kill one of us, that would kill a human. And what scientists have found is, you know, we know radiation destroys DNA, but Dinococcus apparently has backup copies of its entire genome. And these backup copies are separated into four compartments. So even if this radiation shreds its DNA, it can piece it back together, or it can copy entire sequences from these backups, which is pretty amazing that it evolved, you know, this single cell creature.
Yeah, I know, right? That is amazing and super extreme.
Yeah.
So I think we can agree that bacteria are absolutely amazing and intriguing. But their relationship with people is especially fascinating, because, you know, you have some types of bacteria that are harmful to people. They can cause infection and disease. And then there are some that produce antibiotics that help fight infection. And then we have this other complex relationship with the trillions of bacteria that live in our bodies and help to keep us healthy.
So that brings us to today's mystery, which is, could humans live without bacteria?
Now, the thing about bacteria, which we were talking about before, is that for a lot of people, they associate bacteria with infection and disease. So it's a natural step from there to just associate bacteria with being harmful.
Some bacteria can be harmful, but how do they actually make people sick?
Well, for bacteria to affect us, they have to invade the body through cuts or wounds, or they have to be ingested in food or liquid. And then once they're inside your body, they produce toxins that they either excrete or secrete while they're alive, or they release the toxins when they die and their cell wall disintegrates.
And some of them can be pretty nasty. They can cause some pretty severe infections.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's definitely true. So there's bacterial pneumonia, tuberculosis, cholera, tetanus, Lyme disease. All of these are bacterial diseases. And yes, they're pretty terrible.
And I think some of the, for me at least, some of the scariest bacterial kind of diseases or infections are the bacteria that cause necrotizing fasciitis, which is basically destruction of the skin and tissue. It's also called flesh-eating bacteria. So it gets into a wound or on your skin, and it just basically starts killing off those skin cells.
Yes. So are we establishing that bacteria are bad and we would be better off without them? Is that what we're doing?
Well, they sound really bad because some of them are pretty extremely bad.
That is true.
But could we live without them, Erin, and would we be better off without them?
Okay. Well. First of all, let's look at the good bacteria, because there are bacteria that also get rid of infection. So antibiotics, they can come from molds. Like the first big breakthrough antibiotic was penicillin, which is a mold. But most of the antibiotics that are in use today that come from natural sources do originate in bacteria. And in fact, the largest genus of antibiotic producing bacteria is called Streptomyces. And so this actually produces drugs that are antibacterial, antifungal, and antiparasitic. It produces immunosuppressants, and it's responsible, and this one genus alone is responsible for over 65% of clinically useful antibiotics of natural origin. So pretty good, right?
That's pretty incredible. Yeah. And I mean, it's just so amazing that we would find drugs to fight bacteria in bacteria. I mean, in other diseases too, of course, or other microbes. So microbe or bacteria are not just helpful for our health. They can also be good for Earth and for all life on Earth.
Right. I mean, they actually are, you know, integral to life as we know it. So bacteria in the soil and in the ocean, they help with the decomposition of organic matter. You know, it would be pretty terrible if things that died did not decompose and just, you know, piled up. So
just exactly. And by doing that, there's, you know, soil bacteria along with cyanobacteria, which is a type of algae, but they actually take nutrients that would be inaccessible to other life forms and make them accessible. So they can turn things like atmospheric nitrogen, you know, the nitrogen gas in the air, and they can transform it into things like ammonium and nitrates, which are forms of nitrogen that plants can absorb and they need to absorb to create amino acids, nucleic acids, which are the building blocks of their DNA.
Right. So, you know, so bacteria, they have a pretty big role in, you know, in feeding a lot of forms of life on Earth. But they're also an important part of the water cycle on Earth. Bacteria do play a part in driving precipitation. I know it seems counterintuitive to think of how bacteria could do that, but there are actually populations of bacteria that are airborne, that sail through the atmosphere, and airborne particles, which can be mineral, but which can also be bacteria, when they interact with clouds, they create condensation, and then this precipitates into falling snow and rain.
I wonder if they fall with the snow and rain.
The condensation happens around their bodies, so probably, but it's also just interesting to think about how, you know, something so small can have such a big impact on something.
Right, to affect
on
weather.
Atmospheric. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, but let's talk more about back to humans. Let's talk more about us and our relationship with bacteria.
Right. So, you know, trillions of microbes from bacteria and fungi and viruses, they actually live all over us. They live on us, inside us, and they are necessary for our survival. I mean, it seems like we should feel them, the ones that are on us, but I guess they're way too tiny.
Right, that we should feel the trillions of microbes that are crawling over us and then through our systems.
The flagella or whatever that they're using to move around.
swimming through our blood and crawling over our skin. Yeah, I kind of want to go take a shower now. But even if I did, I wouldn't be able to get rid of them. So.
And we don't want to.
No, you don't. This is because they are, in fact, necessary for our health and survival. So this collection of bacteria and fungi and viruses, they're known as our microbiome. And the quantity of microbes that make up our bodies is actually slightly more than your body's cells in total, which is also kind of amazing.
Wow, that is incredible. So about how much? I mean, about how much more of mass or do we have of these microbes than our cells?
Well, it's interesting because this is something that was the ratio of your body cells to your body's microbes was previously thought to be 10 to 1. And that's 10 to 1 microbes. So 10 times as many microbes as your body's cells. And this is an estimate that was introduced in 1972, and it's attributed to the microbiologist Thomas Lucky, and it's very, very widely repeated and has been for decades. But it was very recently debunked in 2016 by scientists, and this was reported in the journal Nature. Ron Milo and Ron Sender at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Rehovot, Israel, and Shay Fuchs at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, Canada, wrote that a reference man, and they just use like a generic man as, one who is about 150 pounds or 70 kilograms, 20 to 30 years old, and about 5'6" or 1.7 meters tall, that such a reference person would contain, on average, about 30 trillion human cells and 39 trillion microbes.
Not quite 10 times, but it's more cells. I mean, 9 trillion more.
It is still, yes. And no, it is definitely still more, a person would still definitely be more microbe, have more microbial cells than person cells. But yeah, so in other words, you're basically about as much bacteria as you are human.
So what kinds of things do these bacteria do for us?
Oh my God, Gina, they do so much for us. let's start with the digestive system. So there are thousands of microbial species in the gut microbiome alone. And they help break down certain kinds of foods that otherwise are just, the chemicals in our stomach just wouldn't be able to break down by themselves, like certain kinds of plant fibers. Digestive bacteria also supply us with vitamins like biotin and vitamin K that are not produced in the body. And they're our primary source for some of these nutrients. And in fact, experiments that were done on guinea pigs, and I know you have guinea pigs, Gina, so
no.
I'm really sorry, but experiments that were done on guinea pigs.
Puddles and marshmallow would not be happy.
So cover their ears for this part. So experiments showed that guinea pigs that were raised in a sterile environment where no bacteria where there was no bacteria were actually malnourished and they died young.
Wow. So what about the ones that are crawling all over our skin?
Yes. So there are, we've got microbes on us inside and out. So about 200 species of bacteria live on our skin, according to researchers at New York University, NYU. And what they do is they're almost like a defensive barrier. So these types of bacteria, they keep other kinds of more harmful bacteria from establishing a foothold. So if you do, if you do get some kind of a cut, then you are less likely to have these harmful bacteria just kind of rush in right away, because the bacteria that you have already colonizing your skin are protecting you from them.
Right. So we kind of have this cavalry of protectors.
Right.
All over us. They've established themselves. That makes me think more fondly of the ones on my skin.
So they're your personal defenders.
Right. They do. And they help with our immune system. They help keep us healthy inside as well.
Yep. That's right.
It's been shown that exposure to bacteria, so both the good kind, the benign, and harmful bacteria, it revs up, it primes the immune system so that it's ready to respond to pathogenic or harmful invaders later in life. So it builds up this memory and it knows, we have the tools or whatever to fight these bacteria that are harmful. And so they strengthen you, they strengthen your immune system. And research published in the New England Journal of Medicine showed that children who are sheltered from bacteria, so I don't know, in highly sanitized environments, they have a higher chance of developing asthma and allergies.
So essentially you have bacteria that are special to different parts of your body. So you have your microbiome overall, but then you also have these more localized microbiomes. So, you got the gut microbiome, the skin microbiome, and even the skin microbiome. Microbiologists who study these types of bacteria and other kinds of microbes, they even specify those more specific, more so than just your skin microbiome, because of different parts of your body, there are actually different types of microbes that are specific to, to the different body parts. So even your eyes, as actually recent research has shown, that the eye microbiome is very diverse and protects the eyes against inflammation and infection. But it's the gut microbiome that has actually gotten a lot of attention, and researchers have really focused on not just what these microbes are doing within your gut, but how that affects other types of bodily functions and can affect your overall health.
Researchers have found that people with things like diabetes or inflammatory bowel disease and even cardiovascular disease, they tend to host a different collection of bacteria in their guts, so a different gut microbiome than those without those diseases. And that report was published January 16th in the journal Science.
Right. And then there have also been obesity studies that look specifically at the gut microbiome. And there was one recent study that found that people who are obese, they actually have less diversity in their gut microbes than leaner people do.
And I assume these studies aren't saying that the bacteria cause the obesity or the obesity cause the bacteria, but there's some association between the two.
Right, right. I mean, these are, you know, it's not like any one of these things is a smoking gun for a particular kind of disease, but what researchers are finding is that these are factors that can influence whether or not someone is susceptible to the disease, but there are always other factors that are involved as well. Some of them have to do with lifestyle. Some of them have to do with genetics. So it's not like you can, you know, in this case, you can't point specifically to any species of bacteria or even a collection, a population of bacteria in any part of the body and say, this is solely responsible for a particular health condition. It's way more complex than that.
But it just does show that, you know, research into the microbiome and how bacteria and other microbes impact our health, you know, these studies are really, I think, revving up right now, and they're finding a lot of links, which is, you know, I mean, I guess it makes sense if we're more bacteria than we are human.
Right, right. And some of the, you know, some of the most, or, you know, what I think is some of the most interesting science that's going on is looking at the gut microbiome and not, you know, not how it affects your health in terms of disease, but how it affects your brain. So there's actually, it's called the psychobiome. So there is this, you know, so a lot of researchers are looking into the gut brain connection because they're finding what looks like really intriguing evidence that gut bacteria can affect how you think, how you feel, how you act. And so the mechanisms for how they do this are still unknown, but there's a lot of really compelling evidence that suggests that there is some kind of a link.
And what kinds of links are they finding? Like what kinds of like mental health links are we seeing right now?
Okay, these are a few examples from different studies. So that there's some research that has shown that many people with irritable bowel syndrome also show signs of depression. There have been studies that show that people that are on the autism spectrum also tend to have digestive problems. There are still other studies about people with Parkinson's that show that they're prone to constipation. And researchers have also noticed there's an increase in depression in people taking antibiotics, but not antivirals or antifungal medications that don't affect your gut bacteria. Because obviously, antibiotics, when you take antibiotics for an infection, they're not selective about the bacteria that they target. They'll kill all the bacteria. And this is why it's often recommended if you're taking a course of antibiotics that you take probiotics to sort of replenish the bacteria that
the healthy bacteria.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's also another sort of interesting link between, and this one is physical, but it's between the gut microbiome and actual athletic performance. And so what are scientists finding in this realm?
Right. So this is a study that was published June 24th of this year in the journal Nature Medicine. And this shows that marathon runners and endurance athletes have higher levels of a bacteria called Veillonella in their guts. And this is particularly after they finished a race and compared with people that are not habitual runners. And when the researchers isolated a strain of Veillonella from a marathon runner and administered this bacteria to mice, they found that the mice ran for 13% longer on a treadmill test compared to mice that were not given this bacteria.
Wow. Oh my gosh, I would definitely see, I can see something, you know, like a practical way to use that.
Well, and again, you know, this is not to say that if you have more of this bacteria, you're automatically going to be a better runner, because obviously there are things like training and again, genetics and personal habits that play into athletic performance. But because it's this kind of complex soup of all of these different factors that can affect something like that, it seems like bacteria, and this particular strain of bacteria in this case, could be one of the ingredients.
Right. And it's just, that's, yeah, it's fascinating. Even though it was just found in mice, that it really, they found an actual change of response to the bacteria.
So at this point, you know, maybe rather than asking if we can live without bacteria, the question we should be asking is, why would we want to?
And humans aren't the only ones who enjoy this symbiotic relationship with helpful bacteria. Other living things do too. Here to talk about that is Live Science reporter Yasmin Saplakoglu.
Bacteria. Gross. These teensy microbes are often viewed in a negative light because they can cause a score of infections and illnesses. But some bacteria do not cause us any harm, and in fact, actually help us survive. Our bodies are teeming with helpful bacteria that aid us in functions such as digesting our food and absorbing nutrients. Actually, these single-celled organisms form relationships with many other complex multicellular organisms across nature, and they've been doing so for millions of years. 51 million years ago, ancestors of carpenter ants formed such a bond with ancestors of bacteria known as Blachmania. Now, neither can live without the other. Here to talk to us about this special bond is Ahab Abouhif, a professor of biology at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, who investigates the complex interaction between developing organisms' genes and their environments. Dr. Abouhif, thank you for joining us.
Oh, hello, Yasmin. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about this relationship between carpenter ants and bacteria. What makes it so special?
Well, you see, the bacteria, they produce, you know, nutrition for the ants. They enhance the immunity of the ants. And in fact, these carpenter ants, if anybody's ever seen them, they come in all kinds of sizes. So you have within the colony, the workers, there are small workers, slightly larger workers, and really big workers that we call soldiers. And in fact, the bacteria is essential for creating all those different sizes. In return, I mean, the bacteria doesn't do it for free. In return, the carpenter ants offer the bacteria a protected cellular environment because the bacteria live inside the cells of the ant. And the ant allows the bacteria to get transmitted from generation to generation.
How do the bacteria do this?
You know, it's a very kind of complicated dance. In essence, the bacteria, you know, has to find its way into the ant, and it has to find some stage of development in which it can integrate into the ant. And that was really the focus of our study. And we found that essentially the way that the bacteria got in is through the embryo, the egg stage. That's really the stage at which that complicated dance I'm talking about took place.
How did the bacteria and the carpenter ants even interact in the first place? What happened 51 million years ago?
This is a really, you know, fascinating story and really based on work, previous research from my colleagues. Essentially, ants and it turns out these bugs called hemipteran bugs, okay? Now, hemipteran bugs are not, they're all insects, but they're quite distantly related from ants. So they're not cousins. They're like really distantly related, you know, kind of ants. And their lifestyle is interesting. They have what's called a rostrum, which is this really like kind of spike-like mouth part, which they can put into the branches of plants, and they can suck up what's called the phloem or the juice. And when they do that, they just basically suck it in, they take up nutrients, and they expense the rest of it from their behind. And this is where this came in. They formed this really amazing mutualism with the ants because the ants started, you know, realize that they could actually benefit from the extra nutrients that come out from the behind of these hemipteran bugs. So they started drinking this rich fluid, and in return, they actually started to protect the hemipteran bugs. So the ants offered protection, the hemipteran bugs were giving nutrition, and it was a beautiful mutualism. And it turns out that the Blachmania, the bacteria, the name of the bacteria that we're talking about is called Blachmania, and Blachmania actually was living, or the ancestors of Blachmania were living in the hemipterans. And so they got transferred from these hemipteran bugs through the juice right into the ants about 51 million years ago.
Very interesting. And then they ended up evolving inside the cells of these ants?
That's right. And so they basically came in, and we don't know exactly the details yet. We don't know where it started, but we assume that it probably went to the ovaries. And in the ovaries, the bacteria, because that's where the genetic material that gets passed on from generation to generation is, it's called the germline. And so they probably went into the ovaries and then went into the egg and then started, you know, that's when they had to start to try and integrate into the egg. And because, you know, if you look at the ant before the egg stage and after the egg stage, it looks like any other ant. It's just that we discovered that when you look at the egg stage, this egg is completely rearranged.
How did the ants and the bacteria integrate?
Really, the ant and the bacteria did this together, hand in hand. And what they did was remarkable. If any biologist looked at how they rewired the developmental system, usually the first reaction is the jaw would drop. They took genes that are normally expressed really late in development, and they express, and these things actually organize the entire body plan of the ant or insects, and they started to put them really early. They took genes that are normally in one spot in the egg and they made them into like, turned them into four different spots, and they turned them into a geographical coordination system. The way in which the ant and the bacteria rearranged the developmental system is really remarkable. I think it's one of the great examples showing how development, you know, can really change in response to the environment. It's not something that's hardwired in our genes. It's really this complicated dance of the environment, of bacteria, of our genes, all coming together. And it's amazing what these two organisms, the rewiring in it. And from this rewiring, they're going to teach science a lot, I believe.
What exactly do the bacteria do in the eggs? Do they provide nutrients?
Yeah, well, so, you know, that providing of nutrients, that can happen at any time, essentially, because the bacteria live in the gut of the ants, right? So they get into cells, and then where they're in the cells, inside the guts of the ants. And, you know, it's not so different from humans, by the way. I mean, everybody's talking about our gut microbiome these days and how important it is for our own existence. You know, I mean, you know, it affects everything from our immune system. It provides nutrition for us. It changes our behavior. There's all kinds of incredible things that biologists and scientists are discovering about our gut microbiome. Well, this isn't so different, actually. There is a gut microbiome of the ants, and these bacteria end up in the adult gut.
Do you think these carpenter ants and the bacteria have a very unique relationship in nature, or are there similar examples all around? I know one you just gave were humans.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's the amazing thing. You know, if you'd asked biologists or scientists maybe, you know, 30, 40 years ago, they would say that symbioses are quite rare. You know, they're rare events in nature. They happen, and then, like, you know, sort of the mitochondria, which are the sort of the energy, kind of energy producers of the cell, that was the product, there was a result of the symbiosis. The mitochondria went into like a normal cell, and that's how we got, you know, the eukaryotic cell. And, you know, but that was viewed as one of these like really rare events that never happens. Now with the whole science of genomics and basically sequencing all of these genomes of animals, we're starting to discover this remarkable array of symbioses all around us, from humans to all animals to plants. It's everywhere. And in fact, it's starting to become the rule, not the exception.
Does this research tell you anything about how complex multicellular organisms formed in the first place?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is what was really special about our study, because for us, there were, I think that, you know, if I had to summarize three major things from our study, I mean, one is that we've just discussed now that, I mean, these symbioses are everywhere. There's lots of work on trying to figure out how the bacteria is functioning to help its host and how the host is then, you know, either reacting to the bacteria. There's lots of work doing that. But one of the major mysteries or one of the great puzzles of biology is how do these grand unifications happen in the first place? It's absolutely unclear. How is it that these two distantly related organisms have absolutely, you know, have been separated for millions and millions of years, all of a sudden come to unify and behave as if they're one organisms? And how, you know, the steps by which this kind of happens, I mean, we had no idea. Was it like one radical leap that brought these things together, or was it this kind of step-by-step process? And I think one of the things that we were able to do by looking at, I mean, that's the one thing that ants allowed us to do, because we could look at a large number of the ancestors and their cousins. We were able to reconstruct this whole pathway of this unification and this merger. And we found that it was actually some kind of, it was a really step-by-step process. And it wasn't this kind of, you know, sort of explosive leap that we might have thought that it would be. Yeah, so that's one of our major discoveries. And I think that will help us understand other major unifications. And so we actually, our understanding of these grand unifications, which are thought to increase complexity, were very poor. And I think these steps that we uncovered for this unification can help us understand others.
I'm Yasmin Saplakolu, a staff writer for Live Science, and I've been talking to Professor of Biology Ahab Abouhif. You can find out more about his work online at biology.mcgill.ca/faculty/Abouhif. Dr. Abouhif, thanks so much for talking to us.
No problem. Take care.
Thanks for joining us today for Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. Today's bacteria mystery, Could Humans Live Without Bacteria?, is available as a Life's Little Mysteries article on our website, livescience.com.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter for even more Life's Little Mysteries and for the latest science news. You can also join the conversation in our Live Science forums, where you can pose Life's Little Mysteries questions of your own, or even suggest topics for upcoming podcast episodes. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on new episodes.
What will we talk about next? It's a mystery.
Literally. It'll be another Life's Little Mystery.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals Network.